This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello there, I'm Hayley Stevens, and this is The Spooktator, a podcast which examines the stranger elements of life, society, international culture, and the media. I'm joined by Paul Gannon and Charlie Revel-Smith.
Hello to you.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, hello, hello. This episode will explore what the FBI knew, or knows, about Bigfoot, and what happens to real-life haunted houses. You can find links to the things we discuss in this episode at spooktator.co.uk, where you'll also find ways to get in touch with us, subscribe to us, or follow us on social media, should you wish to. Have you guys been up to anything interesting since we last spoke? I mean, I know the answer to that on your behalf, Paul. I know that you have.
I've done nothing. Well, I went to Los Angeles, and I went specifically to cover the 35th anniversary of the release of Ghostbusters. And it was partially to help with a documentary I'd been a part of, and partially because of this book I'm writing. And I wanted the finale, so I said to the Wizard World, I don't have a finale for my book, even though I've not really planned my book yet, but this is just how I chanced my arm, and said, can I get a free ticket? I'll sort everything else out if I can just get in through the door. They said yes, surprisingly quickly, after I sent a few articles and things their way. And so I headed out there, and it was interesting. It was fascinating because, as a franchise, Ghostbusters is a bit of an odd one in that I think it thinks it's playing with the big boys. So it wants to be a Star Wars, or it wants to be a Star Trek, or it wants to be something like that. But it's not. It's fundamentally not, and it's struggled for years to be a franchise. But with Jason Reitman's film coming out next year, and what with the Paul Feig film from a few years ago, I think Sony are basically saying, this is all we've got, so we've got to put as much money and time into this as possible. And so they had this festival, which was meant to be 3 days, turned out to be 1.5, and involved a screening of the 84 film, all 4K high def, all very pretty, with a bunch of select fans. I was one of them. Got very drunk that night because some guy kept buying me drinks, which is good because the cocktails were $16 each.
Yikes.
Whoa.
Yeah, crazy. But luckily, one guy who was very, very willing to spend money on other people was buying drinks. And then another guy bought the whole kind of row that I was on a round of drinks as well. And apparently, I don't know if this is true, but when I asked who that guy was, he went, oh, he's part of the military of defense. And I was like, oh, all right. So that was fun. but the event itself was nice. It was problematic because they crushed 3 days worth into one. And so a lot of things I wanted to do clashed. Like Dan Aykroyd was giving a talk on his dad's work as a ghost hunter.
Okay.
And that clashed at the exact same time I was doing a Q&A for the Ghostbusters documentary. So I was very disappointed to miss out on hearing Dan Aykroyd talk about this particular subject, because it's obviously informed his work. And it's obviously a big reason why Ghostbusters was what it was. But I've never, so, you know, like from the horse's mouth, so to speak, heard him talk about his dad's work. Because his dad made a book, didn't he? His dad released a book years ago. And Dan Aykroyd likes to peddle that every now and then when he can. So I'd love to have seen that. There's also a guy called Dylan, who was a Ghostbusters fan from the UK. And he was also doing a documentary called Back Off Man, I'm a Scientist, or Parapsychologist. Back Off Man, I'm a Parapsychologist.
Is that Dylan Jones?
Yes. Do you know him?
I do, yes.
Interesting, because he was talking to me about this documentary he'd made about people who saw Ghostbusters and then become ghost hunters. And so obviously Kieran O'Keefe was on it, and other people I honestly don't know. So I didn't get to see that, unfortunately. But as I say, it was fascinating. It was very, very hot. I nearly got sunstroke once or twice. I met Paul Feig briefly. I spilled a drink in front of half the cast of Ghostbusters and the tech crew, because I was in the green room and I'd forgot I'd attached my dangly cool cup to my lanyard. And when I put it down the table and then moved to get my laptop, I just poured the drink across the table and covered it everywhere.
Oh, wow.
And then when I look up, there's like Ernie Hudson and Ray Parker Jr. and William Atherton and Jason Reitman and all these people looking at me like I'm an idiot. And I'm mopping it with a little napkin. So that was fun.
So you said that Paul Feig is there? What is the general among the fans? What is the general attitude towards the third or the reboot of Ghostbusters that came out a couple of years ago?
It was fascinating. I'll say this. There are obviously people there who didn't take to it, right? But when he came out on stage, there was a director's panel. So it was Jason Reitman, Ivan Reitman, and Paul Feig. And when Paul Feig came out, I genuinely expected to be some comedy boos, you know, ooh, rubbish. None of that. And in fact, there's a moment when Jason Reitman said, I couldn't make the film I'm making now without Paul Feig taking all the bullets for me.
Yeah.
And he goes, and Jason Reitman basically said, I love Ghostbusters 2016. And I love that it showed that anyone could be a Ghostbuster. It wasn't tied to these four characters. You know, you could expand the world. And because of that, he can now tell this story with all new characters and things like that. So for that, he got a big round of applause from the audience.
I really liked the 2016 film. It had its flaws, but I think overall it was just really enjoyable fun.
Yeah.
Well, there's an interesting quandary I have. This is all speculation on my part. But the reason why there was never a Ghostbusters 3 earlier was because basically, to get it made, everyone involved in the first film had to say yes. So Ivan Reitman, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, everyone who was majorly involved with the thing. And obviously Bill Murray kept saying no, or Sony didn't like the scripts that Dan would write because they were largely unfunny and very weird. The famous one was Ghostbusters Go to Hell, where hell bleeds over into New York, and so half of it becomes a literal hell on Earth, and the other half is normal. And it's about, anyway, so that was a weird script. And so what happened was, I think at some point Sony went, look, if we're going to keep this franchise going, we need to take it out of your hands. And so Paul Feig took it on, made the film he wanted to make, and a lot of fans thought, well, there you go, we're never going to get a proper sequel, and reacted violently against it. Now, next year, Jason Reitman's doing a film, which, for all intents and purposes, looks like it's Stranger Things meets Ghostbusters. And the plot apparently is about some girl who finds out that something happened in 1984, which directly has an impact on her family and her life. And so she kind of digs up what happened in 84 and probably comes across the Ghostbusters and then puts the team back together to save the world. Something like that, because Jason Reitman was saying, oh, he went through dailies and deleted scenes from 1984 and found some really interesting stuff that he's saving for special flashbacks for the new movie.
Ah, as far as concepts go, I think that's a really strong one.
I mean, yeah, I mean, my problem is fundamentally I don't like Stranger Things, so that's my hurdle to get over. No, I'm not a big fan of it. I don't think it's bad. I was alive in the 80s, so I watched Explorers and Goonies and Monster Squad and all those films like that, which it's basically doing all over again. But anyway, aside from that, what I think's happened is this film will come out, have all the original Ghostbusters in, which it's likely to have, including Bill Murray, and then that will make fans a lot happier and possibly give Paul Feig a chance to make a sequel to Ghostbusters because the universe is now expanded and no one's stressing anymore about whether we'll ever see Dan Aykroyd in the jumpsuit again. So I think this is the way for Sony to kind of get Paul Feig some goddamn respect and also give the franchise fans what they want.
Without kind of crapping on the fans of the 2016 film at the same time.
Well, I mean, the thing is, that whole incident and that whole, when I got involved with those toxic fans, it really put me off geekdom and fandom in general. And I kind of really just started like washing my hands of all that geek tribe speak. And I was just like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to love what I love. And I'm not going to bother sharing it with you, because even if you say I love 2016 Ghostbusters, some dickhead on Twitter or on Facebook or somewhere will still comment underneath, yeah, but it's shit though. And I was like, that's not the point. Yeah. I'm sure you think your mum's lovely, but to me, she could be a cow. It's the same kind of basic logic. You know what I mean?
There's the same kind absolutely. Of the toxic fanboy online thing. It's almost like everybody has to come to the same consensus on something, and so that is everybody has to agree that the 2016 Ghostbusters was a disaster. A friend of mine just like spoke out something like very like small the other day, saying I actually kind of liked the last episode of Game of Thrones, which I haven't seen. I haven't seen any of it, and was essentially torn to pieces because it was the unacceptable opinion to have. Yeah. Everybody had to be united in saying that it was a disaster.
Yeah.
Because it kind of shows your ranks, you know, it shows you what side of the sand you walk on. Not what side of the sand, what side of the line you walk on.
it's like we are the fanboys and we are united in this opinion. And anybody who has a separate opinion, they're just wrong. It's not even just a matter of taste. It is you are incorrect.
I think there is some of that, but I also think there's an element of for example, in the lead up to the finale of Game of Thrones, there were a lot of people posting, you know, how they had never seen a single episode of Game of Thrones. And I think sometimes people who come across with contrarian opinions just for the sake of kind of appearing rebellious and unique, I think they rub people up the wrong way. So there were people who were being controversial with their opinions just for the sake of it. And I think that just ticks people off immediately.
Yeah, definitely.
But I would also say this. I guarantee you the people who probably said the most vitriolic stuff about Ghostbusters 2016 online probably weren't at the fan fest and probably didn't have any interest in going to the fan fest. So
probably didn't watch the film.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's just a matter of people thinking something they grew up with and was fond of, they have ownership of at the same time in some weird little way. And it kind of stagnates creative freedom, because then you got the Star Wars problem where Force Awakens is too much like New Hope. It sucks. The Last Jedi is not like Star Wars enough. It sucks. And so you can't fucking win. So,
isn't it interesting how there's a parallel there with, and we always go back to ghost hunting because we're so boring, but isn't it interesting how there is a crossover there in the ghost hunting communities? People say that the way it's portrayed in the movies and on television is unrealistic, and they mimic what's on television at the same time. So it is realistic, but there's literally no winning. You'll never please anybody and everyone.
Yeah.
No, because that's the other thing as well. It's like, if you like that ghost hunting show, you're not a proper ghost hunter. But if you like that ghost hunting show, you are a proper ghost hunter. It's just this weird sense of where people decide to stand their ground, the hill they want to die on. And sometimes you think, it's just fucking Ghostbusters, mate. I love it. I love Ghostbusters. Yeah, but I'm not going to, you know, crucify myself on the social media cross just to prove a point that I like 2016.
A couple of episodes back, we were discussing the Pentagon disclosure of several decades worth of supposed flying saucer, or at least UFO sightings over America, and how lots of ufologists had seen this as a huge and monumental step, and it was the beginning of more things to come. Now, one thing I don't think that people expected was that the FBI was going to release a file on an investigation it did into Bigfoot in the 1970s. But that is what very recently happened, when the Twitter account for the FBI, which I didn't know this, it is an automated system which releases dated Freedom of Information files automatically. So there was one day it just tweeted out the word Bigfoot and then a link to the file, which came from the 1970s, in fact, 1976. Now, the whole story behind it was certainly interesting, perhaps a little bit misunderstood, but it was reported extensively across particularly the American press, particularly the New York Times, where I got quite a lot of this stuff from. So the FBI tweeted out this link to its files, which was an investigation from 1976, which was put forward by, or submitted by, a Bigfoot investigator called Peter Byrne, who has quite a reputation in America, in Bigfoot circles, both good and bad, to be honest. Now, he claimed to have witnessed several Bigfoots over time, but this incident that he was actually talking about, which led to the investigation, was one where he claimed to have actually taken hair follicle samples, around about a couple of dozen of them, along with a small piece of what could have been skin cells. Now, he sent this off to the FBI quite brazenly, asking, would you be able to look into this and see what it is? And quite remarkably, they actually agreed and said, yes, that we will do it. The conclusion they actually came to was that it was almost certainly a deer hair of some kind, probably as you would expect. In most cases, when scientific investigation is done onto hair samples, it tends to be wolves, deer, bear, all these kind of things that you would imagine being in the American wilderness. Now, there wasn't much more to this story. In fact, Peter Byrne apparently didn't even receive the information from the research. He was out of the country, probably in Nepal, actually, at the time. And the reason why this actually had any kind of impact at all is because the cryptozoological world, they love a hint of scientific credibility. So just the fact that the FBI had looked into this caused quite large ripples. Now, the FBI, when they'd actually specified why they were doing this. They said that they treat all of these things on a case-by-case basis. So I don't think that that, like, on its surface, the fact that they looked into it is particularly impressive. In fact, it was Melissa Hovey Larson, who is the president of the American Bigfoot Society. She was actually just, more than anything else about the findings, she was just amazed that they had ever looked into it in the first place. But in other places, especially in the kind of more fringe areas of the internet, this is, as you can imagine, it's been met with people saying that it's probably some mass cover-up. That there was an investigation in the 50s, I think they were talking about. I don't know if either of you have ever heard of the FBI supposedly researching Bigfoot in the 50s.
I wasn't around, so...
No. No, to be honest, I hadn't either, but apparently in Bigfoot circles, there is always this rumour that they'd looked into it there and then they've lost the files or something because they'd managed to prove that Bigfoot actually existed.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. As you can imagine, this is the kind of approach that at least the comments section on the Coast to Coast report on it took.
Oh, well, there you go. Coast to Coast, yeah. Then.
Is it Melissa Hovey?
Melissa Hovey Larson. This is.
Interesting fact. Before I became a ghost hunter, so I became a ghost hunter in 2005. Before then, I was a member of a forum, like a ghost cam forum. This website where they had all these webcams in haunted places and you would watch them to see if you saw anything.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, and there was this whole community built up around it and I was a member of the forum. I met a lot of friends there who I'm still friends with today, and Melissa was one of the members of the ghost camping. So I knew her, I was friends with her before she became like the president of the Bigfoot whatever. So it's really, really weird.
How interesting.
Small world.
Yeah, I find it so strange how there is no reason just because you have a belief in ghosts that makes Bigfoot more likely to be real, that there are certain people who can skip between one field and the other. But if you have a general interest in paranormal, it makes sense. But I always kind of think of ghosts and Bigfoot at least as being, I don't know, they seem very, very separate entities altogether. Unless you go into the whole idea of like Bigfoot being a ghost, or it's like ghosts of like early man and things like that, but that's very free. That's sort of fringe within fringe societies. That is.
Do you think it's because like people get disillusioned with ghost hunting, and so maybe they go, I need something a bit more quote unquote scientific and concrete, and that still tickles their kind of paranormal thing. So they go to cryptozoology and they go, oh, but there's a picture of a Bigfoot.
Yeah. And, oh, look, there are these weird markings. And, oh, look, there's a sound. Yeah.
And if you're the kind of person who likes having a mystery to solve, it probably feels more possible that you could do it with Bigfoot.
Yes.
Because if there were giant apes living in, particularly in the American wilderness, but I know that it's supposedly all over the world, it should be an achievable goal to discover this creature. Because America isn't infinitely big.
But I get the impression that most like Bigfoot hunters think a Bigfoot's like Pete's Dragon, where they'll find one, have an adventure, and then at the end find a magical land that no one's ever seen, full of Bigfoots all living in harmony.
Well, it's the end of Harry and the Hendersons, isn't it?
It is as well.
You see like the whole, it's like Bigfoot land where Harry returns to his people.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is about half a mile off the road that you were just driving on. How would they manage to stay hidden?
Oh, it's magic, you fool. It's all wormholes and magic and portals.
Don't question it too much.
The idea of there being a conspiracy theory, like led by the government to hide Bigfoot, I have absolutely no idea why that would be.
This sounded like a press thing where the FBI went, here's something that doesn't matter to us, let's toss it out online. There'll be a reaction to it, there'll be some discussion. The FBI will get trending on Twitter. It's all good.
I mean, it certainly was a big discussion. There were people talking about it on Twitter. And for us, outside of the groups of people who are perhaps more invested in this and want to see more scientific or government spending on the search for Bigfoot, most people were just thought it was slightly embarrassing that the FBI had done this.
There's also that.
And why had they ever investigated Bigfoot? Now, I think there are several reasons, like legitimate reasons, why you would do this. not just because it was 1976 and the 70s were a time where lots of these fringe things were going mainstream, but I think that it's actually really quite a fun investigation to look into. Because if you look at what they're doing, is they've been given hair samples, animal hair samples, and the investigation is, what actually is this animal from? So once you take the whole Bigfoot thing out of it, that's actually really quite good practice for when you are doing more legitimate research. You kind of have like the hypothesis, in this case, is this possibly Bigfoot hair? Your conclusion, no, it's deer hair. There are times when the FBI would actually be doing things like that, that have nothing to do with Bigfoot whatsoever. So you're kind of just doing it as a practice kind of thing. It made me think about, it was a few years back, I think it was 2010 or 11, where the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, they wrote a thing about how to survive a zombie apocalypse. Yes. The things that you would do, how it would likely spread and things like that. But what it was really doing, it was just like, it was teaching you how to deal with things like food shortages, riots, all of these kind of things, which you might legitimately have to confront at one time. But it presented it in this way that wasn't alarmist, and it was sort of fun. It got people talking. But all of the information you needed to know was still there. It was just presented in more of an interesting way.
Yeah.
I would like to actually look more into the Bigfoot conspiracies, because I've never really understood why there would be any call to. It's not that much of a remarkable claim, really. It's not an impossible claim that there would be some kind of primate that had been undiscovered. It would be incredibly unlikely, but it's not the sort of thing that's going to cause mass panic.
No.
Or something. If anything, it would actually be incredibly profitable for America, you would have thought. People were like, we have proof that this thing exists, come and see it. I guess there could be like an argument that it's being protected from hunters or things like that. But for the most part, the only people who are ever in this wilderness to begin with are hunters anyway. So it's hardly like it's been, Bigfoot has been wiped out by hunters. Otherwise, there would be taxidermied Bigfoot all over the place. And
I think the Bigfoot conspiracy is that hunters invented Bigfoot to defend their right to hold guns and have arms.
Or maybe, yes.
That's what I reckon. There. That's my conspiracy theory, internet. Have fun with it.
So there we go. Another month, another strange disclosures from America, and this time Bigfoot. So let's see what it will be next month.
I'm just having a look into why people would think the government are covering up. So I found...
I just told you.
Yeah,
hunters,
I meant actual...
They want to keep shooting things.
Actual reasons. Like, not ones...
That's an actual reason. How very dare you?
Like, I meant from actual conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, what is like the official line that these people have? Is it that it's like to protect their habitat or something like that? Because... I would imagine that if we knew that Bigfoot existed, it would go smack bang immediately onto the endangered species list.
So is it Quora.com? Q-U-O-R-A? Quora?
That's how I've always pronounced it.
Yeah. So someone's asked on there a number of years ago, is the government covering up the existence of Sasquatch? And some people said, no, what's covering the existence up is called reality. Somebody else put, I would imagine probably so, simply because of the repercussions of acknowledging their existence. Unlike the opinions of people who answered below, there are many reasons why the government would cover this up. People would be scared to go to national parks. It would affect the timber and logging industry. And then there's more of the moral questions of, are these a primitive type of human? And if so, do they deserve the same rights we have? Do they deserve reservations or special land set aside for them? It would also disprove a lot of anthropology and history. There are many more reasons to cover it up than to acknowledge it. Just look at what the spotted owl did to the timber industry. Imagine if we had a large population of subhumans, apes, or somewhere in between. It would disrupt everything.
Don't see how when there's only one of them.
Yeah, that's true.
Or is there only one, though? That's the thing, because when you look at maps of where Bigfoot are spotted or Sasquatch is spotted in the US, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
And you find that these different regional towns have their own version of Bigfoot, and there are some variations in the activity that's reported by them and so on. Now, obviously, people like Greg Newkirk from the Travelling Museum of the Paranormal and Weak and Weird, and who was one of the producers of Hellier, he kind of puts forth the idea that Bigfoot is a sort of crypto-terrestrial creature, in that it's more of a ghost than it is a cryptid, and more of like an elemental or interdimensional being.
Yes, so you can sort of pass into this dimension from another one. And so yes, that's why we just see fleeting glimpses of it as it kind of passes. So
yes. And I have seen other people say that the government has a job of protecting citizens, you know, all around the world. The government's meant to protect their citizens. And so for our own good, we don't know the full details of things. So I agree with that to an extent. So with like the UFO, the Navy UFO protocols that we covered in a couple of episodes ago, there are things about that we don't know and probably will never know. And I think that's probably for the best. But some people do apply that logic to all sorts of absolutely crazy ideas. The idea that, oh yeah, there are Bigfoot just roaming in the wild, but you'll never know because the government don't want you to know because they think it's best that you don't know. But the idea that people would be too scared to go to national parks and stuff is ridiculous, because whenever there are Bigfoot sightings in America, what tends to happen is you see these YouTube videos of people who go out in their pickup trucks with their dogs and beer and their guns, and they go looking for the Bigfoot.
Not to mention that there are, every year, there are several attacks on humans in America by wild bears. And that doesn't prevent people going into the wilderness. Now, that's a genuine, legitimate thing that happens. And as far as I know, this is where I'm immediately going to be corrected by somebody writing, and I'm sure there has never been someone claiming, like a claimed Bigfoot kill of a human being, as far as I know.
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure. But I'm sure if there is someone listening who knows of a claimed Bigfoot attack or murder, murder by Bigfoot, let us know. I would love to learn about that.
I tend to think of Bigfoot as being sort of peace-loving, but that might just be Harry and the Hendersons because of that.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Which is Harry and the Hendersons' government propaganda. BBC World Update recently produced a really interesting feature on their website about a Japanese man called Akira, who has found a niche in the Japanese housing market by buying, renovating, and selling property that is said to be unlucky. The video is in Japanese, but in it, Akira says, and I quote, "Once I was asked to look after a property with 15 graves in the middle of nowhere on top of a mountain. I sell haunted houses. I'm the ghost estate agent." The video goes on to explain that in Japan, many people believe in haunted houses and that ghosts haunt the living if they died a lonely death, killed themselves, or were murdered. Akira has been selling haunted houses for 5 years, despite many people not wanting to live in them. In Japan, these properties are called jikobuken. He repairs and renovates the houses and then tries to sell them at a cheaper rate than a regular house. He says, "Most of my clients who buy jikobuken are from the young generation. The majority of them don't believe in the existence of ghosts." He has dealt with about 500 haunted homes, but a declining population means that there are more homes than people. According to the National Institute of Population and Social Security, Japan's population is expected to decline from 127 million people to about 88 million people by 2065.
Wow, that's quite a staggering drop, actually.
It is, yes, when you consider that's only, what, 46 years away?
Yes. Yeah.
So for Akira, the number of jikobuken are increasing. In the documentary, Akira says, "I think the good point of this job is it always relates with someone's death and helping their family in that hard moment." And he says, "It might sound strange to say this job is interesting, but that is our motto." Now, jikobuken, I had a quick look into them. It roughly translates to the black property or marked property or incident property, which references the fact that there is some sort of stigma attached to the house. And I looked into it and I found that Japanese law is quite specific about what property can be classed this way. And these properties tend to be where a murder or suicide or a natural death occurred, including cases where the body wasn't found for a while. Properties near criminal gangs and where they operate. Properties constructed on top of wells. Properties that are near waste treatment facilities or a graveyard or a crematorium. Properties made by or on ground once owned by cults. Properties with a history of fire, flooding, or other things that cause death or injury, such as asbestos poisoning. and properties with complicated histories regarding ownership, as shown in the registry listings, such as having a lot of owners over a short period of time, people moving out before their leases are up, and so on. Apparently, these properties, especially those associated with death, are considered to be unlucky, which is why it can be difficult for estate agents or landlords to find new tenants or owners. But the rise in interest in these properties comes from a desire for affordable housing for younger people who are struggling financially. So you might think that this is a trend that you'd see in many other different societies too, a willingness to take a property with a less desirable past for a hefty discount. But that might not be the case. Personally, I wouldn't mind moving into a cheaper house or renting a property for cheaper just because someone thinks it's haunted.
No, it sounds like a great deal to me.
It's like a win-win, isn't it? It's perfect. Yeah. But here in the UK, an infamously haunted property in Essex known as The Cage is proving impossible to sell. Now, The Cage has featured on this podcast before. In fact, back in episode 5, the fifth episode of the show, we discussed an alleged ghost photo that had been taken by ghost hunters, which they claimed showed the apparition of a witch who had been imprisoned in the building in the past. The owner of The Cage, of this house, is a woman called Vanessa Mitchell, and she opened the house up to ghost hunting teams over a decade ago because she claimed it's so haunted and active that she can't live there, but she has to pay the mortgage, she has her bills to pay, so she has to make money from it somehow, you know, to meet her overheads. And she claims that it's haunted by many apparitions and that it's extremely active, but now it appears that she's learning you can't eat your cake and have it. The Mirror reports, and I quote, and this is like typical Mirror language, a house dubbed the most haunted in England may be sold as a holiday escape for thrill seekers after estate agents warned it could be impossible to sell as a normal home. Vanessa Mitchell, who has owned the building since 2004, says her time at the house was plagued by hauntings and that a ghost there pushed her over while she was pregnant. I mean, you're really selling the property. This is, you know, this is making me want to buy it, you know. Yeah. She fled the house in 2008 and has been trying to sell it since. And now the home is back on the market for £240,000. Estate agents at Home Domus 360, who have taken charge of the sale, say they are pinning their hopes on a buyer who appreciates the paranormal. Spokesman Florent Lambert said Vanessa can't live in the house because of the ghosts, and she has tried to sell it a few times over the years without much success. He goes on to say, I think it's going to be pretty impossible to sell the house, which you don't want your estate agent to go on record to say.
No.
No, I pretty much would have straight away go with a different estate agent.
Yeah, exactly. You want someone to be like, oh yeah, this is the best house. I'm going to sell this house. It's amazing. Not
just to have a little bit of confidence about the property.
Yeah, you know, this is an amazingly cursed building.
Well, and also, proper landlord would, estate agent would say, lovely little place, you're getting it cheap because some mentals think it's haunted, yeah. So snap
yeah,
it up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? It's like...
He goes on to say, there's such a big following and such a big market for the paranormal in the US and Japan, and England is obviously a place of a lot of history and reputation for ghosts, and there's a market to turn the property into a holiday cottage with a twist, the twist being its paranormal edge. No, dude. No, this is not working. Nobody wants to stay in a holiday cottage where a ghost is alleged to have tried to kill a woman who was pregnant. I mean...
They need to give it a cool name for the franchise. Like I suggest Air Boo and Boo.
Very nice.
Maybe try that.
I suggest you don't ever say that again.
How dare you? I'm bringing gold to this. I'm so ill.
I'm trying to think of an alternative, but I generally can't come up with anything.
See.
Yeah.
But there was an advert on a bunch of bus stops a few years ago. I can't remember what it was. It's an online website that's, you know, was involved in property. But one of the bus stop signs was something like, did you know we sold blah, blah, blah number of haunted houses this year?
Oh, that was Zoopla.
Zoopla, thank you.
I remember taking a photograph of one and just being like, what the shit is this?
It's a weird one because then you've got like people saying, oh, well, we'll take your allegedly haunted house and doll it up and sell it on and make it a cheap sale because, you know, of its legacy. And then you've got the whole people who sue landlords and estate agents because they didn't say it was haunted when they bought it or they didn't know. Like, for instance, Dennis Nielsen's flat in Muswell Hill, I'm pretty sure went quite cheaply. When they tried to get someone in after he was, you know, arrested.
Yeah.
And even though it's not haunted, you're still living in a place where bodies were piled in the cupboards and floorboards for a while. So that mental thing can affect people. I mean, not I couldn't give a tit about it, but...
I would imagine, though, that even if you didn't care too much about what had happened there, I mean, not that you're an uncaring person who doesn't care that people got murdered, but it didn't affect you living there, you probably still have to deal with people turning up outside and, like...
Well, yeah.
See, I would be fine... living in a place that was supposedly haunted, but if there was a place where people had actually, if people had been murdered and buried in the walls and things like that, I probably would struggle with it. And it is just superstitious me coming out there that I would just feel there was something had gone wrong with the house itself, almost like it had been damaged, as, you know, as completely superstitious thinking there is, I would struggle with it. I think that's why quite often places do get torn down.
Yeah.
Well, like I say, Fred West Place got torn down because you just think they could never sell that property because it's one huge, massive boil on the stain of humanity.
But also they had a lot of people who were, even when it was an empty property, people turning up and kind of not making it a shrine necessarily, but making it a sort of a...
A tourist destination.
Yeah, so they tore it down before that could become an actual thing.
Yeah.
And then you've got things like at the opposite end. Imagine you live in the Amityville house and there's not been a single case of a haunting there since whenever it was first, you know, abandoned by the family, the Lutzes, Lutz, thank you. But every time they make a movie, that just means the people who live there will all of a sudden start getting visited by fans. So every now and then they pump out another movie because of the IP. And I believe they are making a new Amityville movie based on the family.
I think it's getting a reboot again, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that lived there and the son who killed the family. They're remaking that story again. So imagine they bring out another Amityville film and all of a sudden your quiet little cozy house is now being surrounded by Warren fans and things like that.
Ugh, yeah. The article that discusses the cage being hard to sell, the estate agent goes on, as though he hasn't already said enough. He says, the article says, Mr. Lambert said his research indicated that most of the previous owners had only kept the cage for roughly 3 years before selling. A previous owner had also committed suicide in the house, he found. Like, dude, what are you doing?
Even you can't just announce that, can you?
I don't know.
I mean,
it seems very poor taste, at least, even if legally you can get away with it.
I mean, yeah, potentially, yeah, it is poor taste. It's really poor taste.
Do you know what I'm more afraid of? Taking over, you know, moving into a flat that was once owned by students. I think that's more terrifying to know. Like, oh, in this corner, you can still hear the moans of an 18-year-old chundering his guts up after too many bottles of vodka. Oh, the spirits. You know what I mean? It's like, what's been spilled here? What's been not washed up? That's kind of more grotty than me than a house that might be haunted.
Well, when we moved into the house we live in now, this was when I was 18, and the previous owners had been growing pot in the top bedroom. So the top bedroom is basically the full width and length of the house. It's like a... almost like a studio room on its own. And they had sectioned part of it off. And we thought it was just a really big, nice walk-in cupboard. But that had been where they were growing pot. And so for the probably like the first 6 months that we lived here, we just kept finding things in the house. So when the day we moved in, we discovered all the electrics were weird because they had rewired the electrics to feed power up to the top room.
Oh, yeah, because it needs tons of light, don't they?
Yes. And so you would put on a light, switched on downstairs, nothing would happen, but something was going on in that top bedroom without you realising it. and we went into the attic to put some stuff in storage, and we found all these empty grow bags and some fertiliser up there, and we just kept finding things. It was an absolute nightmare, and like we would have people just walking in the back gate. We'd be in the garden, and someone would just walk in, and you'd be like, oh, yeah, they don't live here anymore, sorry.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was mad. So, yeah, I'm with you on that one. It's actually the living that have been in the house before that can be... Yeah.
I absolutely love that thing about attics, though, is that there is so often there is just really good stuff there that gives you some idea of who the people were before.
Yeah.
Because it's rare that people completely clear out their attic when they move on, and quite often you can find all kinds of just gold up there, you know, completely worthless stuff, but little trinkets that give away something that, because the rest of the house usually doesn't have any evidence of them whatsoever. There is just this kind of like weird, slightly kind of spooky space that has still got remnants left over from the other people. I love it when that happens.
And hopefully not literally remnants of the other people.
Well, no, there is that is a concern as well.
So it looks as though they are aiming to turn the cage into a holiday cottage, which is really, really strange to me because we've discussed, as we've discussed on the show before, Vanessa Mitchell, who owns the building, she plays a lot on the fact that at some point it may have been used to house, to imprison people accused of witchcraft before they then went on to be tried. And so that's why it's called the cage, because they were caged there. And paranormal teams go into the cage a lot. I know that John Fraser, who's one of the council members of the Society for Psychical Research, he has done some investigation there and says that it seems like a compelling place. And ghost hunters who visit there have a lot of strange activity that happens to them. But when I wrote about the cage a while ago on my blog, there was a piece of evidence, I think it was some photographs that seemed like they had been faked. And I did a blog post about this and I had a lot of people leaving comments on this blog post who had been on ghost hunts there, who said that when you visited the cage, you were basically told what to expect and you were led around each room and told, this is the, I don't know, the stairway and this is what you'll experience here and you'll see this and you might see this. And so there was a lot of emphasis put on the haunting, which to me, sometimes it's that kind of seems that at odds with somebody who is so distressed by the fact that they own this property that's so paranormally active, they want to sell it, but then will go and completely oversell the haunting to the ghost hunters. It's kind of like there, it's almost like there's two aims and they're neither of them kind of gel with one another. So I can never really, I don't know, I can never really get a proper read on what's actually going on at the cage.
I just like to buy it and then ban all ghost hunters from going in it and I'll have all the ghosts to myself.
Just kind of sit in the window with a cane 2 meter, waving it out the window. Yeah. Like, you can't come in here.
Saying it's all mine.
And then I become the guy who haunts the cage because I'm the guy who basically sits there in the window every night, just waiting in the dark.
And they see you after you've passed away, still there.
Yeah.
Shadowy figure.
Still holding a K2 meter.
And holding back the curtain that's no longer there.
Yeah, then people take a picture of me and then you say it's not real.
Yeah, because deep down, Paul, what is real?
Well, that's deep.
Yes. So this has been another episode of the Spooktator podcast. Remember, you can find links to everything we've discussed at spooktator.co.uk, where you can also find links to our social media accounts and the different ways you can subscribe to the show. Remember, we're now on Spotify, so you can follow us and listen to us on there if you wish. We'll be back soon with another episode. Until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.